Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, December 3rd, 2021. U.S. economy adds 210,000 jobs in November, below most economists' expectations, but the unemployment rate falls more than anticipated, by 0.4% to 4.2%. There will not be a federal government shutdown after a late Thursday night agreement in the Senate to hold a vote demanded by Senate Republicans on an amendment to try to stop the president's COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The amendment failed, and then the 11-week extension of government funding passed, and President Biden signed it into law today. On COVID-19, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky assuring the public the government is ready to respond to the Omicron variant, saying it may be a more transmissible variant than Delta, but further research and time is required to know for sure. And she emphasizes the Delta variant now is the one causing illness and death, and people should concentrate on current preventive measures, especially getting vaccinated. And the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy asked about calls that he sanctioned Republican House member Lauren Boebert over her comments about Democratic member Ilhan Omar, comments that Omar calls Islamophobic. That and more coming up on Washington Today. Reporting from CNBC, President Joe Biden glossed over the weak November jobs report Friday, instead focusing on the low unemployment rate and the year-long trend of growth and economic recovery. U.S. economy created far fewer jobs than expected in November, in a sign that hiring started to slow even before the announcement of the new Omicron COVID variant, Labor Department reported earlier in the day. Non-farm payrolls increased by just 210,000 for the month, though the unemployment rate fell sharply to 4.2% from 4.6%. And the labor force participation rate increased for the month to 61.8%, highest level since March 2020. That was from CNBC. President Biden speaking about this today in the White House State Dining Room. He started his remarks, though, talking about the federal government funding bill to avoid a shutdown that he signed. You'll then hear him talk about the jobs report.
Before I start, I'd like to report that later today I'll be signing a bill funding the government operations for the next few months. Funding the government isn't a great achievement. It's a bare minimum what we need to get done. But in these times, a bipartisan cooperation is worth recognition. So I want to thank Senators Schumer and McConnell and Speaker Pelosi for getting this done. And I want to thank a substantial bipartisan vote in the Senate for sending this bill to my desk today to avoid disruption of government operations. And I want to urge Congress to use the time this bill provides to work toward a bipartisan agreement on a full-year funding bill that makes the needed investments in our economy and our people, from public health to education to national security. Now, for today's news. Every year, December brings the joys of the holiday season and gives us an opportunity to reflect on the year gone by and look ahead and begin to imagine the new year to come. This year, we can reflect on an extraordinary bit of progress. Our economy is markedly stronger than it was a year ago. And today, the incredible news that our unemployment rate has fallen to 4.2%. At this point in the year, we're looking at the sharpest one-year decline in unemployment ever. Simply put, America's back to work, and our jobs recovery is going very strong. Today's historic drop in unemployment rate includes dramatic improvements for workers who have often seen higher wages and higher levels of unemployment. They are receiving higher wages. And the rate of Black and Hispanic unemployment is also dropping sharply. But that's not just jobs that are up. Wages are up, especially for hardworking Americans, often ignored in the past and past recoveries. Workers in transportation and warehouses have seen their wages go up approximately 10% this year. Workers in hotels and restaurants have seen their wages go up 13% this year. And thanks to the American Rescue Plan, we've delivered significant tax cuts to families raising children. Tax cuts and raising wages for middle-class families mean that Americans, on average, have more in their pockets today than they did each month since we've been in office than they did last year after accounting for inflation. Let me repeat that. Even after accounting for rising prices, the typical American family has more money in their pockets than they did last year. In fact, we're the only leading economy in the world where household income and the economy as a whole are stronger than they were before the pandemic.
President Joe Biden at the White House. We'll have more on the jobs report coming up in a moment. But first, after the president finished his remarks, he took a couple of questions, and the first one was about his health. You could hear it in his voice. It's hoarse, and he's also been coughing.
First of all, Mr. President, your voice sounds a little different. Are you okay?
I'm okay. I have a test every day to see a COVID test. I have it checking for all the strains. What I have is a 1.5-year-old grandson who had a cold who likes to kiss his pop. And he'd been kissing in my anyway, so but it's just a cold.
Later, the White House releasing a memorandum from the physician to the president, Kevin C. O'Connor, to the White House press secretary that reads, "The following is released with permission of the patient. As is readily apparent, President Biden is experiencing some increased nasal congestion this week. This can be heard in his voice, and he is feeling the colloquially well-known frog in one's throat. Investigation has included a comprehensive respiratory panel, which includes 19 common respiratory pathogens, to include COVID-19, other coronaviruses, influenza, streptococcus, to name a few. All of these tests were negative, including the above. He has been tested for COVID-19 three times this week. Treatment will include common over-the-counter medications for symptoms." That memo from the physician to the president. Now back to the November jobs report. Fox Business writes the labor market had been gaining momentum after a Delta-induced slowdown over the summer, but the latest figure represents a significant drop from October's upwardly revised number of 547,000 and September's upwardly revised 379,000. Again, the figure for November was 210,000, and Fox Business concluding there are still about 3.9 million fewer jobs than there were last February before the crisis began. The Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh, was interviewed today on MSNBC.
Secretary, all the data shows that our economy is doing well, but this new number, it's clearly a miss. What happened?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's a miss. I mean, every month that I've been standing here, the forecast has been either higher or lower, and they've been different. I think at the end of the day, when you look at the story here during President Biden's administration, we're seeing a lot of success. We're seeing a recovery that's working. We're seeing nearly 6 million jobs added to the economy. We're seeing nearly two points dropped off the unemployment number. We're seeing people in manufacturing, construction, in those areas that quite honestly have been underperforming even pre-pandemic are doing well. We certainly have work to do. There's no question about it. But I would say that, you know, we have to look at the whole picture, not just month-to-month snapshots.
Okay, then given all of that, and add in the biggest CEOs in this country are saying the supply chain issues are improving, the price of gas is dropping, consumer demand is up. Those are all big positives in addition to what you just laid out. Put all of that together and explain to us why then are the president's poll numbers dropping?
I mean, I can't talk about the poll numbers. I think people, you know, President Biden, if you look at what he's already accomplished in a short period of time, it's really remarkable. I mean, he's working hard. He's passed two major pieces of legislation. He's working on a third. He's focused on, in this recovery that we're seeing, some low-wage workers, earners, are actually making more money. They're seeing his plan when he ran for president was to help people get into the middle class. And if you look at the job gain in our country, a lot of it is in areas, even the folks that were making less money in the past, they're making more money. They're actually outpacing inflation as far as earners. But, you know, we just have to continue to move forward. This is a cycle. I mean, a lot of concern in this country with the pandemic. People have gone through a lot in the last 20 months, concerned about their health, concerned about their family, concerned about their job. And I just think we're living in a time right now that we just have to take a day at a time and be patient with one another.
Labor Secretary Marty Walsh on MSNBC this morning. The National Republican Congressional Committee, which raises money for House Republican candidates, tweeting, "After another horrible jobs report, it's clear President Biden and House Democrats are building back broke while middle-class Americans pay the price." A video was attached. It has cable channel news clips of the jobs report.
You know, I said we're going to build back and we're going to build back better. Not just, we can't just build back, we got to build back better.
210,000 on non-farm payrolls, a huge miss.
210,000, and again, that is a big miss.
Only half the level we anticipated, 210,000.
That's less than half of what economists were expecting.
Many people's wage gains are not keeping up with the inflation that they're facing every day.
Video tweet from the NRCC, which raises money for House Republican congressional candidates. And at the end, it had on the screen Build Back Better. It was crossed out and better replaced with broke. Congressman Kevin Brady of Texas, top Republican on the Ways and Means Committee, which handles taxes and health care and trade, among other things, tweeting, "This is a miserable jobs report. President Biden is nearly 1 million jobs short of promises from his last $2 trillion spending bid. Senate ought to suspend consideration of $5 trillion BBB for Build Back Better until the president demonstrates he can heal the economy, lower inflation, and get Americans back to work." And the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, speaking about the economy and the president at his weekly news conference today in the House Radio and TV Gallery in the Capitol building.
When I look at President Biden and I look at his year of working with the Democrats with one-party control, think about what they promised us. He promised he would shut down the virus, and he hasn't. President Biden's only strategy so far has been to threaten Americans with more arbitrary COVID restrictions and mandates. He told us inflation would be temporary. Well, we realized that's not true. Just this week, the Federal Reserve Chair and Biden's own Treasury Secretary said that it was time to retire the word transitory. Chairman Powell could not even confirm whether consumer prices would even let up over the next year. I don't know what the press secretary is doing in the White House today, but maybe they're coming up with a new term to try to dismiss inflation concerns. After his policies caused gas prices to skyrocket, he said he would lower the gas price. He hasn't done it. He's even made it worse. And no, not the measly 2 cents. The DCCC thinks is lowering it is a reduction. He depleted 50 million barrels of oil from our emergency supply and has done nothing to reverse this anti-American energy agenda that he has contributed to spike our costs. In my home state of California, you see the price rise almost every day, more than $5 a gallon. That hurts the hardworking Americans every single day. It's not just the gas price. If they take that, fill up the car and they go to the grocery store, it costs them more. If they turn on the heat, it costs them more. Everything they do. And now we've come to Christmas. We worry about the ability to even get the gifts you want or whether you could even afford them. But what's the answers that we get from the White House? He can't even promise you that the Christmas gift will arrive on time, if you could even pay for it. The American people are fed up with this one-party rule and what has come of it in just 1 year. When Americans take the majority next year, we make this commitment to every single American. We will listen to you. We will hear you. We'll work on your policies, and we will improve your quality of life.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, today on Capitol Hill, his weekly news conference. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 59, NASDAQ down 295, S&P down 38. That was all today. It has been a roller coaster week. For the week, the Dow dropping 0.9%, S&P down 1.2%, NASDAQ falling 2.6%. Amid the disappointing November jobs report today and also the COVID concerns. And on COVID, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky saying, while the emergence of the Omicron variant is a cause for concern, the federal government is monitoring it and studying it in depth. The dominant strain in the U.S., she says, is still the Delta variant, so the best course of action now is the same as it has been. Vaccinations, booster shots, face masks, hand washing, distancing, etc. Dr. Walensky took part in a virtual briefing of the White House COVID-19 response team.
We are equipped and prepared to fight the Omicron variant head on. We're actively taking steps to stay ahead of Omicron. Yesterday, CDC issued a health advisory through our Health Alert Network to provide recommendations to public health departments and jurisdictions, laboratories, healthcare providers, and the public in light of the new Omicron variant and what actions are needed now, including testing protocols and guidance for case investigations. Notably, we are urging providers to get all eligible Americans boosted right away. Additionally, CDC is providing support to enhance and streamline genomic sequencing nationally and is expanding surveillance of international travelers. Our CDC laboratories are working in collaboration with public health and academic partners and across agencies to understand the science of this new variant, assessing its susceptibility to therapeutics and vaccines. We are continuously monitoring vaccine effectiveness in our real-world surveillance studies and publicly reporting those data. And we are doing an in-depth investigation of the first initial cases of Omicron so that we can understand transmission and severity of Omicron disease. I know that the news is focused on Omicron, but we should remember that 99.9% of cases in the country right now are from the Delta variant. Delta continues to drive cases across the country, especially in those who are unvaccinated. So here's what's important to know. Our recommendations for protecting against COVID remain the same, regardless of the variant. Our best protection against COVID-19 is our proven layered prevention strategies. This includes getting vaccinated if you have not already, and getting a booster dose if you are eligible, along with wearing a mask in public indoor areas, frequently washing your hands, improving ventilation, physical distancing, and increased testing to slow transmission of the virus.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky is director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Omicron variant first reported in South Africa just a couple of weeks ago. It has since been detected in about 40 countries. And this week, first cases in the U.S. were identified in Colorado, Hawaii, Minnesota, and New York. Associated Press writes, new COVID-19 cases in South Africa have burgeoned from about 200 a day in mid-November to more than 16,000 on Friday. Another top U.S. government scientist at today's White House briefing, Dr. Anthony Fauci, asked by a reporter when we might know more about how Omicron moves from person to person.
First question, let's go to Dan Vergano at BuzzFeed.
Thanks. I guess this is for Dr. Walensky or Dr. Fauci. What is the point at which we'll know how transmissible or immune-evasive the Omicron variant is? Is there a certain data point, or is there a certain number, the share of infections we should be seeing? When does that become clear, just how bad this thing is? Thank you.
Dr. Fauci, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, there are two phases to that, Dan. One is to take a look when we get the virus in a form to be able to use it as a parameter of antibody neutralization. The other is a much more easily usable one called the pseudovirus. And what you do is you get the sera from people who've been vaccinated, people who have convalescent plasma or monoclonal antibodies, and you measure the capability of those to actually neutralize the virus. Then there will be the clinical indication. That would give you a laboratory prognostication of what you might expect. But then clinically, when you follow, and right now, the South Africans, as we mentioned, because of the volume of cases that they have thus far, are ahead of us in the sense of being able to take a look at differences in protection, immune evasion, severity of disease in people who have either been vaccinated, people who have been unvaccinated, or people who have recovered from prior infection. That's all going to take a matter of maybe a week or two more to get the in vitro data, and maybe another additional week or so to get the clinical data. So we expect we're going to have that information to you over the next few weeks.
Dr. Anthony Fauci directs the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, part of today's virtual White House COVID-19 response team briefing. Also announced today, the Biden administration shipping 11 million COVID-19 vaccine doses abroad, with 9 million going to Africa, another 2 million to countries around the world. Today's shipment bringing the total number of doses sent to Africa from the U.S. to 100 million. Also this from the Wall Street Journal, the Food and Drug Administration is laying the groundwork for the rapid review of Omicron-targeted vaccines and drugs if they turn out to be needed, according to people familiar with the matter. The agency, building on rules established earlier this year to assess shots and treatments, has been meeting with drug makers and setting guidelines for the studies and data needed to swiftly evaluate products targeting the new Omicron COVID-19 variant, the people said. You can read more at the Wall Street Journal website, WSJ.com. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which is available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. More on that last-minute deal in the Senate that allowed a stopgap government funding bill to pass Thursday night and avoid a government shutdown at midnight tonight into Saturday when current funding would have expired. Zach Cohen is a Senate reporter for National Journal. He explains how some Senate Republicans pushed for and then got a vote on an amendment designed to try to stop President Biden's private sector COVID-19 vaccine mandates.
Congress had sort of come to a head on today, who should have been a potential shutdown deadline. Basically, on September 30th or the week of that, Congress said had not yet reached an agreement on full government funding bills. And so they punted to this Friday, December 3rd, as a new deadline to try to come up with some sort of agreement on how to fund the government for the full fiscal year. However, a couple of conservatives, people led by Roger Marshall, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, had basically said, we're not going to vote for, let alone allow a vote on in a timely process, any spending bill opening the government, as long as there is not action to try to stop the Biden administration's efforts to mandate the vaccination or regular testing of private employees. Now, this is something obviously that has been stopped by the courts. It's not yet fully in effect, but this is something that conservatives, especially in Congress, are very worked up about and very interested in doing something about. Now, because a final deal on another stopgap spending bill hadn't been reached until a couple of hours, really, yesterday before this deadline, the Senate really had very little time to take up this bill and needed unanimous consent, so to speak, in order to bring up the bill, even though it had come over from the House and had the support of over 60 senators in the final vote. What ended up happening was they ended up getting a vote on an amendment that ultimately failed that would have defunded the vaccine mandate by OSHA. And the bill is now going to President Biden, where he's expected to sign it.
Because that amendment failed yesterday, does that mean the issue regarding those senators' efforts on vaccine mandates is over at this point?
Far from it. It's a good question. So Senator Mike Braun from Indiana has a resolution under something called the Congressional Review Act that he can force a vote on as soon as next week. That would do the same thing. That would basically roll back the OSHA regulation. It's something, a power that Congress gave itself to basically on an expedited basis, expedited in sort of congressional terms, usually takes a couple of weeks, to roll back any professional regulation they disagree with. And that should actually be successful. Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, has said he would actually vote for that resolution next week. And all 50 Senate Republicans have already said they also support it. What Manchin and other Democrats especially didn't want to do was add this particular resolution or repeal of a regulation to a government funding bill and potentially jeopardize it, not just in the House, but with President Biden and potentially cause a shutdown. So that resolution should come to the Senate floor next week. It would then go over to the House, where it would, if it's not killed there, then President Biden would ultimately veto it. And it seems very unlikely that there would be a veto-proof majority in either congressional chamber in order to overturn that veto. So the vaccine mandate, at least in law, is going to stay, even though, as I said earlier, the courts have sort of put a pause on actually implementing it.
Zach Cohen is a Senate reporter for National Journal, joining C-SPAN on Friday morning's Washington Journal. That amendment offered Thursday night by Republican Senator Roger Marshall, along with Republican Senator Mike Lee, to remove funding for President Biden's vaccine mandates from the 11-week government spending bill, the temporary bill, failed on a party-line vote. The vote was 48-50, Republicans voting yes, Democrats voting no, and there were two Republicans in the Senate not voting. Here is some of the debate Thursday night before that vote, starting with Roger Marshall, Republican from Kansas.
This amendment is simple. It prohibits monies from this bill to be used to fund or enforce the White House's COVID vaccine mandates on the American people for the duration of the CR. As a physician, I've always supported the vaccine, and I encourage Americans to talk to their doctor about getting vaccinated and about the booster. But whether to receive the vaccine or not is a personal choice. It should not be mandated via unconstitutional executive actions that the administration acknowledged earlier this year they didn't have the authority to put in place. No precedent exists in American history for punishing private employers who don't enforce government vaccination edicts. As we all know, multiple federal courts have put a stop to the OSHA mandate, as well as the federal contractor and CMS mandates. What's more, thank goodness the White House even delayed implementing their mandate for federal workers until after the holidays. Mr. President, this is an opportunity to right a wrong, for each member in this body to right a wrong. Let's give employers certainty and employees peace of mind that they will still have a job this new year. Make no mistake, these vaccine mandates are not about public health or science. If they were, the White House would recognize that 92% of Americans, 92% of Americans who have already built up immunity to this virus between vaccines and natural immunity.
Senator Roger Marshall offering his amendment Thursday night. Senator Patty Murray speaking in opposition. She's a Democrat from Washington State and chair of the Senate Health Committee, also the assistant majority leader.
COVID-19 has killed over 780,000 people in our country. This pandemic has a higher body count than any war we have ever fought in, and it's not over. We should be doing everything we can to stop this virus. We should be using every tool to keep America safe. We all know the damage this virus can do to our communities and to our economy. That is why the Biden administration has taken steps to urge employers to make sure their employees are fully vaccinated or test negative for COVID-19 before they come to the workplace. That's a move that's widely popular with the American people. No one wants to go to work and be worried they might come home to their family with a deadly virus. Even businesses support this step. The Chamber of Commerce is urging businesses to comply with the administration's emergency temporary standard. And perhaps more importantly, it's a move that will save lives. We've already seen these requirements have a huge impact. In fact, many businesses with vaccination requirements have seen vaccination rates rise well above 90%. OSHA estimates that the federal standard, which Republicans are fighting to undermine, will help protect 84 million workers, prevent thousands of deaths, and over 200,000 hospitalizations from COVID-19. I do not understand why, after all families have been through, after all we have lost and all the hard work we've done to rebuild, would anyone want to throw that in jeopardy and throw away one of the strongest tools we have to get people vaccinated, keep them safe, and end this pandemic once and for all. It is senseless. It's reckless. I urge my colleagues to vote against it.
Senator Patty Murray on the Senate floor Thursday night. The amendment from Senator Roger Marshall was defeated, and then there was a final vote on the temporary government spending bill. Announcing the result from the presiding officer's chair, Senator Angus King, independent from Maine, and you're going to hear reaction from the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York.
On this vote, the yeas are 69, the nays are 28, and the bill is passed.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
I'm happy to let the American people know the government remains open. Thank you.
From Thursday night, 19 Republicans in the Senate voting yes, along with all 50 members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate. And Friday morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, holding a formal ceremony to sign the paperwork on that temporary government spending bill. It's known as enrolling the legislation to send to the president so he can sign it into law. House Speaker Pelosi talking about the Senate Republican effort to defund the vaccine mandates and also about, she says, the need to pass a full fiscal year government funding bill so more short-term bills won't be needed.
This particular legislation is legislation to keep government open for the people. It's really regretful that all the work that has gone into it and all the negotiations that have gone into it, that only one Republican voted to keep government open. How could it be? There are two areas that we've had some, shall we say, debate in the Congress. One is governance. Do we believe in it to keep government open for the people? The other is science. Science in terms of how we deal with a pandemic, how we deal with the climate crisis and the rest. And we've had major disagreement in terms of the Republicans rejecting science and rejecting governance. What this legislation has in Senate, one of the assaults that were made on it was that they wanted to prevent any funds in the legislation to be used for enforcement of vaccinations. And that's science and funds governance. So I signed this to send to the president with great tribute to our appropriators. The chair of the committee, Rosa DeLauro, has done a remarkable job. She held together what we call the anomalies in the legislation that help us meet our responsibilities to Afghan refugees coming to our country. This is probably one of the cleanest continuing resolutions that we've had, because we have been able to resist so many good ideas that people had, but the fact is it's a continuing resolution. And there were some urgencies that Madam Chair was able to negotiate with the Republicans in a bipartisan way and have it.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, joined by other House Democrats, including Rosa DeLauro, chair of the Appropriations Committee, at the enrollment of the bill, the temporary government funding bill, for another 11 weeks until February 18, 2022. White House says President Biden signed it into law Friday afternoon. From TheHill.com, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said Friday that recent political distractions caused by a trio of conservative rabble-rousers, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, and Paul Gosar, are things that Republicans would not want to deal with and result in problems as his party tries to win back the majority in 2022. A pair of related incidents consumed House Republicans this week after Boebert suggested that progressive Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, a refugee and one of just three Muslim Americans in Congress, could be a terrorist. Those racist and Islamophobic remarks were condemned by fellow first-term Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace during a CNN appearance. The back and forth sparked more intra-party warfare in McCarthy's conference. Green, a Boebert ally, took to Twitter and attacked Mace as trash. Mace responded in kind, calling Green profanity crazy. The offensive comments and GOP fighting came just a couple of weeks after Gosar was censured and booted off his committees for tweeting an anime video depicting himself killing Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. That's all from the Hill newspaper. And this line as well: Gosar, Green, and Boebert are all members of the House Freedom Caucus, which is aligned with former President Donald Trump. You can read more at thehill.com. Questions about this today to the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy.
Are Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, and Lauren Boebert distractions to winning back the majority next year?
It's things we would not want to deal with. It is things that the American people want to focus on, stopping inflation, gas prices, and others. And anything that deviates from that causes problems. Yes.
Regarding Representative Boebert's Islamophobic comments, why do you have such a hard time condemning something that is so clearly wrong?
Let me be very clear.
I'm just speaking about this particular instance.
Let me be very clear. This party is for anyone and everyone who craves freedom and supports religious liberty. Lauren Boebert, as I called her when it came forward, we talked. She apologized publicly. She apologized personally. I contacted Steny Hoyer and even talked about maybe Steny and I should be in the room. We should lower the temperature of this Congress. We should work together and talk to one another. In disagreements and something goes astray, you apologize for it. Exactly what Lauren Boebert did. What's interesting to me, and I didn't get to watch Speaker Pelosi's press conference, did any of you raise the question when someone on their side of the aisle said, "I work with the Ku Klux Klan," referring to Republicans? Did anyone on your side of the aisle talk about when Omar said, "The only reason I support Israel, it's about the Benjamins"? I never got a public apology or a phone call. Or did anybody on your side of the aisle, I think you might have asked Speaker Pelosi about this one, when Congresswoman Omar referred to America and Taliban as equal? Because I remember Speaker Pelosi saying something to the effect, and I could be wrong, but it was to the effect that she did not denounce her for saying that. So, I think when somebody does something that is wrong, they apologize. Lauren Boebert apologized publicly and then picked up the phone, and it took a lot of effort. She wanted to meet personally, denied the ability to meet personally. When she picked up the phone and she called Congresswoman Omar, she said, "I want to personally apologize to you." And that's what she did. I think in America, that's what we do. And then we move on the issues that need to take place.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. House Democratic leaders say they are considering sanctions against Congresswoman Boebert, including censure and removing her from committees, but have not decided on any course of action. Republican Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan speaking today about the threats he received for one of his votes in favor of the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that recently became law. He was one of 13 House Republicans to vote yes. In the Senate, 19 Republicans there voted yes, and the bill has been known as the bipartisan infrastructure law.
I've gotten some death threats, more than a handful. But one of the worst ones that came in was a gentleman, well, I can't say gentleman, a guy from South Carolina. And my immediate response was, you know, his senator, President Trump's best friend in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, Lindsey voted for the bill when it passed 69 to 30. And had we taken it up then in August, most observers think we would have had 40 to 60 Republicans that would have voted for the bill. Trump was against it. He said he had a better bill. His bill was more expensive, no pay fors, and got people to sort of get off the wagon to get this bill done. But it was held hostage then by the progressives in the Congress. They tried to get the Build Back Better plan attached to this and ultimately failed, which is why they voted against the bipartisan bill at the end of the day. But, you know, for us, the people that helped write it, the actual blueprint, particularly in the Problem Solvers Caucus, we won't get a back off from a need that we knew had to pass.
Congressman Fred Upton, part of his interview today with The Washington Post. He also spoke about sharing a moment with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar about what the two have been going through and how similar it is.
I had never talked with my colleague Omar all the day she's been in Congress. Of course, I know who she is. I know she knows who I am, too. I'm usually on the Republican side of the aisle. She was attacked as well. She released some of the tapes of people going after her earlier this week that were very, very nasty. And I was looking for her on the House floor, and I couldn't find her. And so I asked my good friend Debbie Dingell, where does she usually sit? Because I don't, you know, she wasn't in her normal place. And so Debbie followed her, and she brought her over to me. I said, you know, I don't know you all that well. We've never talked. We both had a mask on. And I said, you can't see my smile, but I'm smiling behind this mask. But I just wonder if the same person that went after you publicly, and again, she released the transcript, they used the same words against me. And I had a monogram on my shirt, and, you know, my initials, you know what they are. I said, They use more than just my initials in going after us, but I wonder if it's the same person from South Carolina that went after you. So she started laughing when we had a good conversation, and you got to sort of put it in that light. But on the seriousness of stuff, I'm really afraid someone's going to get hurt.
You can find the full Washington Post live event with Congressman Fred Upton at our website, cspan.org. From Reuters, any move by China to invade Taiwan would have terrible consequences, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Friday, adding that he hoped Chinese leaders would think very carefully about not precipitating a crisis across the Taiwan Strait. Blinken, speaking at the Reuters Next conference, said China had been trying to change the status quo over self-ruled Taiwan, which Beijing claims is its territory, and that the United States is resolutely committed to making sure the island has the means to defend itself. Also talking about Taiwan today, the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman. This was a program that C-SPAN covered, hosted by the Brookings Institution.
The United States is obviously engages very closely with Taiwan, and Taiwan has been invited to the Summit for Democracy next week is the latest example. But around the world, many countries and private sector actors that are seen to offend Beijing on this issue are often punished for it. What can the United States and the EU do to show solidarity in a meaningful way with those smaller countries and actors to deter sort of the use of coercive economic diplomacy that we've seen from Beijing?
Thanks for the question, Tom. I think you heard some of it from Stefano as he was talking about the European Union's approach to Taiwan within the context of a one-China policy, which we have as well, as you know. I think what you want to see is that all of us stand together in support of those countries that are facing economic coercion, that we give them assistance and support in whatever way is appropriate for that country. It's not just small countries. Australia has seen economic coercion from the PRC as well. So we need to make sure that we stand in solidarity, we provide whatever support we can, that we provide alternatives. To go back to something Stefano said earlier, that we actually deliver for countries, that they know that they have a strong partner who will stand with them, that will share their values. Taiwan is an important contributor in the global conversation. They bring a lot of expertise. One of the reasons for their participation in the Summit for Democracy is because they are experts in disinformation, which is quite critical to building democratic values and democracies, to make sure that our citizens have facts and information, and they have a lot of capabilities to share with other colleagues, again, within the context of our overall One China policy. So there's a lot of work to be done here. There are a lot of players in the Indo-Pacific. I should have mentioned earlier when you asked about who we were working with in doing both Global Gateway and Build Back Better World. I should have mentioned our strong partnership with India as well, and the Quad mechanism with Australia and Japan, India and the United States, which is another forum working with European Union as well, where there are many ways that we are all contributing to a stronger Indo-Pacific.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, a forum hosted by the Brookings Institution. It also included a European Union official. Associated Press reports that China and the United States are tussling over President Joe Biden's upcoming democracy summit, which the ruling Communist Party sees as a challenge to its authoritarian ways. The party maintains China has its own form of democracy and plans to issue a report titled China, Democracy That Works on Saturday, 5 days before the opening of Biden's two-day virtual meeting with about 110 other governments. Thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. For more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.